Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, your home for stock market news and ideas to help you beat high inflation by getting you investing for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. And a very warm welcome to episode 6 of season 5. In today's episode, we've got an interview with Simon French. He's the chief economist from a stockbroker called Panmure Gordon. He also used to work at the Bank of England, and he's going to explain a couple of things. He's going to take us through some of the key takeaways from the disastrous budget that our Chancellor delivered at the end of last week. And he's also going to have a look at inflation a little bit, talk a bit about why it's remaining so stubborn, really. In our market section, lots going on there. We're going to look at the turmoil and in particular what's been going on in the UK's markets, in currencies, in gilts, the government bonds as well, as well as a little look around the globe as well. I'm also going to explain what the Bank of England has recently announced it's doing, and then we've got some quick company news headlines, which include for Porsche, Apple, Twitter, and H&M as well. Please share with friends if you are enjoying the pod. And many thanks to our sponsors, Janus Henderson Investors, for their support, helping us educate and inform private investors. Okay, let's get going with the markets and basically give you a little update on what we've been chatting about with the market analysts at Hargreaves Lansdown. And, you know, I think in recent times, it's actually been all eyes on the UK, which I'm sure you're not surprised to hear. We have been spreading a little bit of misery on the back of a certain Chancellor's so-called mini budget. I'm going to discuss this in more detail with Simon French in a sec, so hang on for his very expert analysis. So what happened? Well, last Friday, Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng announced his somewhat radical budget that was an all-out bat for boosting economic growth with plenty of supply-side reforms, tax breaks, some new debt was going to be issued as well to pay for lots of it, and promises of deregulation. And yet, by throwing so much of Rishi Sunak's tax rises on the bonfire, markets clearly felt that these unfunded cuts were foolish in a time of hot inflation. As a result, the pound has been dramatically weakening, almost reaching parity with the dollar. And also yields on government bonds, so they move in the opposite direction to prices. And government bonds here in the UK are known as gilts. Those yields have spiked very sharply. In fact, the sharpest spikes it's seen in 35 years, so even more so than 9/11. The Bank of England initially said that it would look at moving monetary policy at its November meeting. Of course, it's only just raised its interest rates last week by 0.5%. But then in came a volley of stinging criticism from some very well-respected institutions, including the US Treasury and the IMF, who said tax cuts would fuel not just inflation, but inequality too, and rather soberingly, said that UK was taking on characteristics of emerging market economies, trade disruptions, an energy crisis, and soaring inflation. As such, back went down the pound and back went up the gilt yield. Of course, this creates a knock-on effect amongst other types of debt, other loans and bonds, and so suddenly you could see pretty safe companies facing having to refinance their bonds at much higher rates, which of course is not great for their cash. But also the mortgage market has been doing flips, as you would expect. And, you know, it means that a gear change is likely in the housing market. The Bank of England suddenly found itself in crisis mode. And rather than waiting till November, it announced it would go on a fresh spending spree to stabilise the bond market. It meant that in a week, the yield on a 10-year gilt, so that's lending money to the government for 10 years, has gone from under 2% in early August to hitting 4.6% this week before the bank stepped in. It's now at around 4.15% today. Still at these levels today, that's a one-year increase of 313%. Not good for markets, while the FTSE 100 companies generally benefit from a weaker sterling due to high foreign earnings. The budget shock is stark. Interest rates are only going one way, which will pound consumers and companies. And confidence in the UK's economic management is unfortunately shredded. Elsewhere, well, last week we heard from the Federal Reserve, the US central bank, and it has raised its interest rates by 0.75%. With pretty low unemployment in the US, it means the Fed is being perceived as likely to remain on this harsh path of raising rates, because that's an environment that's quite conducive to inflation. So it is what we would call being hawkish. As a result, it sent markets downwards pretty sharply, although they recovered a bit yesterday. Still, US hikes are strengthening the dollar, which affects gold, copper, and other metals. In Europe, things haven't been great because of fears of an escalation to this horrific war in Ukraine. Putin is obviously doubling down, and he's set to annex four regions on Friday. In China, there was some marginally good news in that Hong Kong was lifting some of its COVID restrictions to the city, so there are expectations that the rest of China should follow soon. More broadly around the world, higher rates are really affecting markets because investors are having to contemplate the end of an era of cheap money and reassess what this means for company profits. All in all, over the fortnight, the S&P 500 is down 4.67% to 3,719 points. The FTSE 100 is down 4.47% to 6,952 points. Europe's Stoxx 600 is down 8.94% to 384 points. And Japan's Nikkei 225 is down 5.22% to 26,422. So just to, on the next section, I just want to pick up a little bit on what the Bank of England is doing, really, and what buying government bonds does for the economy. So, of course, the problem has been since this announcement from the Chancellor and this sudden lack of confidence in the economic management, that big investors have suddenly dumped the bonds of the UK government. So they've suddenly rushed to sell them, really. And that means that yields spike. They go up because yields move in the opposite direction to price. The prices are falling as they're sort of getting rid of these things. And that has a big knock-on effect on other types of debt, as I mentioned, so corporate loans and bonds, and tightening financial conditions in the UK, because, of course, that reins in the cash that companies have. And it will impact pension funds and the mortgage market as well. Indeed, many banks and building societies started pulling loans and hiking their rates. And because this sell-off was so sharp, the Bank of England sees this as a panic, as disorderly as it calls it. And that in itself threatens the financial stability of the UK. So what it does is it steps in and says, right, if you, all you lot want to sell all this stuff, then we'll be the buyer of those bonds. So the banks, the pension funds, the hedge funds, all of those big institutional sellers now have a big, big buyer for those financial instruments. So that then stabilizes that pushes the price up, and it means the yields drop a little bit, and it enables then the money from those sales to flow elsewhere into the economy. Its plan is to buy longer dated government bonds, I think 30-year bonds, I think it was, at a rate of 5 billion per day for 13 days. So just to act as a bit of a circuit breaker, a bit of a, right, okay, we're going to step in here, we're going to buy these things, all you, cool your heads, basically. So whilst it seems like QE, it's not quite the same, really. It is just a short-term measure. It's not going to go on for a long period of time. I think given all the red flags that have been raised, particularly by the IMF, about the government's economic plan, it will be very interesting to see what they do next. Okay, before we get on to our interview with Simon French, let's have a little look through some of the headlines. What have I been finding interesting? Well, Porsche has managed to shrug off the rather grim market conditions in Europe and listed its shares on Frankfurt's stock market for the first time. That's an initial public offering, an IPO. And they managed to get a valuation. So if you were to value the whole company off the back of some of the shares that it sold, of 75 billion euros. So pretty good, really. VW is the bigger company that majority owns Porsche. And what it's doing, it's using these proceeds, around 9.4 billion euros, to pay for investment in electric vehicles, which of course makes sense. It's also going to hand out a special dividend to its investors. Apple has said that it started making its new iPhone 14 in India. That was launched just last month. Clearly, as it moves to diversify some of its supply chains, particularly away from China. Their zero COVID policies have caused issues with all sorts of supply chains, and the mood music is that sort of relationships are changing a bit with the US as well. So it's creating risk for Apple, and then clearly they want to diversify some of those risks. We heard that some big brands, including Dyson, Forbes, Mazda, I think some others as well, had to suspend their ads with Twitter because they have been appearing next to tweets associated with child pornography. So obviously Twitter bans illegal content such as child pornography, but it does have a thriving adult porn sharing community. So that's where I think these things were emerging. H&M has been feeling some heat as well. It reported to the market its quarterly profits and said they were pretty low because of rising costs on account of sort of surging raw material and shipping costs and a strong dollar. But also it took a hit following the unwinding of its Russian business following Ukraine's invasion. So as such, it's embarking on an annual savings drive of $177 million. Okay. Let's get on to our interview with Simon French. I thought now would be a good time to revisit some economics, given how much is going on at the moment with, of course, inflation at decades-long historical highs, but also with the new government that's in place and Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng, who's delivered this mini-budget, as he puts it, that many would describe as bold. I think a few would describe as quite radical. And of course, we were going to have a little look at the implications that this might have for the economy and investors too. So I'd like to welcome back onto the pod broker Pamela Gordon's chief economist, Simon French. Simon, welcome.
Marcus, thank you for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to join you.
Okay, let's start with the mini budget. There was a lot of discussion, as I mentioned at the top, about this budget that Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng delivered last week. What would you say were the biggest announcement out of this in terms of the impact on the economy?
So there were probably three that really will impact people's day-to-day lives. The first thing was some quite considerable personal tax changes. For most people, that was the bringing forward of the 1p reduction in the basic rate of income tax a year early, into 2023 rather than 2024. But then there were some surprising increases at the top end of personal taxation with the abolishing of the 45p additional tax threshold. So some big personal tax changes. Second big one, albeit it was pretty well flagged, or they were both pretty well flagged, was the reversal in Rishi Sunak's increases in corporation tax and national insurance. Those are more impactful for businesses than in personal income tax or national insurance payers. But I think as a size of the package, that's about £30 billion. And then actually there were some signals, and I would say they are mainly signals at this stage, on some of the deregulatory reforms that this government plans to pursue on ending the moratorium on offshore wind. They're looking to abolish the bonus cap on bankers' bonuses, and actually some really positive stuff, I have to say, on increasing work search conditionality for universal credit claimants. And that's really important given something we've spoken about previously, which was the rise in inactivity and worklessness in the UK economy since the pandemic.
Okay, interesting. You heard a lot this term around supply side reform. So there was a lot of that in this budget. What do we mean by this?
Yes. Yeah, so supply side is the ability of the economy to provide, if you like, the capability to do what businesses and consumers want to do. And so if you are a business looking to recruit, a supply side reform would increase the number of people on offer to you by improving their skills, reforms to the migration regime so that you can get a greater number of people who are suited to your sector coming into the labour market, but also the enablers of being able to do business. And you can think of infrastructure, the built environment, but also health interventions, occupational health, work on the NHS to try and improve the healthiness of the population. All that together can be bucketed in as supply side reforms that enable the potential of the economy to be maximized, rather than what you hear on the other side of the equation, which is demand side stimulus, which is just making, for example, debt cheaper, which is the classic lever by lowering interest rates, which you stimulate demand in the economy.
So the ultimate purpose is to try and boost growth. We heard that a lot as well. Will this work?
The jury's out. And I have to say, since the announcement, markets have taken a fairly negative view on the question, will it work? But they are not judge, jury and executioner. They're providing a short-term, albeit fairly objective, signal. I think one of the challenges is this is such a change from the what I've called the macroeconomic framework, which is a bit of a mouthful. But what it means is the type of interest rate policy, the type of spending policies, the type of tax policies that we've become used to over the last 13, 14, 15 years in the UK. It's such a shift from that I say markets are skeptical. And one of the reasons they're skeptical is because some of the proponents of this economic doctrine were also some of the big proponents of Brexit. And whatever you think about the merits or otherwise of Brexit, it has been quite disappointing in terms of its economic impact on the UK economy in the last 6 years. And therefore, I think markets look for signals that this might be a repeat.
Now, you mentioned the bonus caps going. We've also heard that there's going to be some deregulation for the city coming down the road later this year. Is this, you know, what impact will this have on the city and investing?
Yeah, quite positive. So I wasn't expecting during the Conservative leadership campaign, which was only this summer, but it feels already a long time ago. I didn't expect the eventual winner, Liz Truss, to be talking about Solvency II, MiFID II, bankers' bonuses. I didn't think necessarily would be the top of the agenda for reform, given it's how politically contentious it is. But you are right to say that it does signal that deregulation to take advantage of the advantage the City of London and UK Financial Services has is one of the things that we're going to hear more about from this government as it tries to, if you like, leverage its comparative advantage. I think it's, you know, broadly welcomed in the city, but of course, dare I say, the devil is in the detail, because we've got some broad principles at the moment, but with regulation, it's always about how it is subsequently defined, but also how your biggest trading partners respond to what is, I think, quite clearly now a shift away from EU regulatory standards and financial services, at least over the medium term.
So if we're going to sort of, I suppose, you know, rounding all of this off, you mentioned some of the reaction from markets there. I think the big thing that we're seeing, and it's certainly reported on a lot, is that the pound has become very, very weak. Why is this?
Yes, I think it goes back to the earlier points we were discussing, which is skepticism as to whether what is quite a radical change in macroeconomic policy, what that will do longer term for UK growth. If you're investing in the pound, if you want to own pounds, if you want to own assets denominated in pounds, you think that the returns you're going to get, either from the company earnings, the size of the economy, all these things are going to move in your favour vis-a-vis owning Bunds in Germany or JGBs in Japan or US Treasuries. or indeed equities in any of those countries. I have to say, based on the response of financial markets, the marginal investor has said, gosh, this is quite a gamble. We're going to sit this one out and wait and see what crystallizes, rather than, you know, supporting, if you like, off the bat straight away, the idea that this will work in terms of increasing trend growth towards the government's new target to grow the economy at 2.5% a year.
And what impact is this going to have? I mean, we don't know how long, I suppose, that the pound is going to trade this weekly. But if it does continue, what impact will this have on the economy?
Well, I know we're going to come on to talk about inflation, but I mean, the major transmission from a weak pound is higher prices for consumers. Why? Because quite a lot of what the UK purchases, both its businesses and its consumers, are imported from overseas. And clearly those become more expensive if the pound is weaker. So the major transmission is through to, if you like, more stubbornly high inflation than we otherwise would have had with a stronger pound.
Okay, so then why did the FTSE 100 rise this morning?
Well, to some extent, that is because a lot of the FTSE 100, the companies that sit in that index, have foreign earnings that become, it's almost the flip side of this, they become more valuable in an environment where those foreign earnings, once translated into pounds, as the pound goes down, those foreign earnings become more valuable. So we don't always see this, but a lot of the time, the FTSE 100 and the pound move in opposite directions as a logical extension of those foreign earnings amongst the 100 biggest UK public companies.
I see. So this is because I think it's something like 70% of FTSE 100 earnings come from overseas. So that just means when you earn foreign currencies and your own currency is weakening, then you'll get more of that of your own currency when you translate it back and you get those foreign earnings.
That's right. And I would add, what you make an excellent point in terms of that data. I would add, this is something to celebrate, actually, because for investors, it is a hedge, if you like, because a lot of investors, particularly UK-based investors, will have assets, be it their property or other UK-based assets, that will become less valuable as the economy weakens, as sterling goes down. Now, clearly, if they have exposure within their domestic share index to foreign earnings that go in the opposite direction as sterling weakens, that's nice diversification. That's a nice hedge. We shouldn't overstate it, but at these times when the economic picture has certainly darkened, it's a welcome side effect.
Okay, well, you mentioned inflation. Let's get on to that a little bit. We're obviously in the midst of quite an intense cost of living crisis. The latest reading was 9.9% in August. So what's going on and why is it not going away?
Well, it would be perhaps too simplistic to just say, well, there's a war on Europe's eastern border, but a big, big part of what we are seeing at the moment as regards inflation is a function of, and the word exceptional, unprecedented, or those two words are perhaps overused, but when it comes to wholesale gas and by extension electricity, energy prices, then I don't think they are unjustified. The average gas price in the UK for the decade leading up to the start of this year was about 50p per therm. Now, we are currently trading across the forward curve for the next 2 years about 10 times that level, about 500p or £5 per therm. Now, it's very, very difficult in an environment where you've got that level of inflation coming through on something that you just have to have. I mean, UK businesses, UK households have to have electricity, heating, and their ability to substitute out and use other sources is fairly limited. So that is the single biggest component part of why inflation is about around 10% and why it's remaining stubbornly high.
Okay, so that critical component of everything, be it households or businesses, then feeds through into the prices of absolutely everything, which is why you get this very broad-based kind of inflation. Is that right?
Absolutely right. And I think you're teeing up, I think, a very sensible part of the conversation, which is, it's one thing to have this big commodity price shock, which generates, if you like, the initial inflation. But of course, energy price inflation, the longer it goes on, it starts to permeate into what economists would call second round effects, other parts of the economy, the services industry, pay settlements, the cost of doing business, the ability of companies to absorb those cost increases and not pass them on has been, I would say, exhausted over the last few months, few quarters. And therefore, those second round effects on almost everything within the economy at the moment are the things that worry central bankers, they worry economists, they should certainly worry interest rate sensitive assets, because they tend to be stubborn, they tend to be sticky, they tend to persist year on year, whereas energy prices that are short, sharp shocks tend to dissipate quite quickly.
Mm. So what's your view in terms of this, becoming embedded? Because it's certainly what we heard the Fed getting a bit concerned about this. I mean, I think this is the worry amongst big institutions, that it's becoming embedded. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I the pleasure of being on the podcast, I think it's my third occasion being on the podcast, is, look, people could go back and look at the back catalogue of what I said. And I was in the camp that saw inflation as transitory. I'm happy to own that. I'm not happy, but I'm certainly not going to shy away from owning that forecast. I didn't see the big energy price shock, the war crystallizing. And therefore, the result has been so sustained, so pervasive around the economy, that central banks like the Federal Reserve, but indeed all central banks now, are raising interest rates because they see those second order effects writ large across the economy. They're worried about them getting embedded. They're worried about how much it's going to cost people going forwards. They're trying to lean against that with higher interest rates to try and bring domestic inflation down. It's a really, really uncomfortable thing for central bankers to do. It's where they never want to be, but I'm not sure at the moment they've got much of an option.
Why is it so hard to foresee this? I mean, you mentioned that, you had been one of many, many economists out there, many institutions that have got an awful lot of resources in order to model these sorts of things. Why is it so hard to see these things coming down the road and sort of get these big points kind of wrong?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I'm pleased I've got the opportunity to answer it, because when you do economic forecasts, any forecast is conditional on the assumptions you pick. And a big one is, what is the energy price going to be, the gas price, the oil price? And economists such as myself, such as the Bank of England, such as the Federal Reserve, the good news when it comes to energy markets is there is a very, very liquid, heavily traded forward market that gives you a price out 2, 3, 4, 5 years in the future. And you can historically rely on that market to give you your conditional assumption. You don't need to make a judgment. I don't need to make a judgment on the balance in energy markets. I can just take that future market. And if we go back to when I previously spoke to you on the podcast, the forward curve for UK gas prices showed a brief pickup, because I think there was always going to be a considerable crunch because of some of the demand that we'd seen in parts of Asia, also parts of Europe, ahead of the war. But once the war hit in Ukraine, that curve fundamentally shifted, both went up in terms of the price, and it stayed high for much, much longer. Now, if any of your listeners can think of a better assumption than me taking a futures market that is heavily traded by traders who have skin in the game, they make their living by trying to get these numbers right, if they can think of a better way, I'm all ears. I'd be absolutely delighted if they could share with me something. But the reality is, it's quite difficult to think of something better that doesn't introduce just a different type of error to the potential error of the forward curve. That big trading market might be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had an oil analyst on the podcast, and he described very adeptly why it's just so complex, just to, you know, from his specialist point of view, to think about where the prices are going to go. So of course, for an economist then to use those specialists to then insert, you know, their view basically into their own models, you can see why they do that, and why it's impossible to predict black swan events, I suppose. That's what this war in Ukraine sort of represents. So I can see that there. Okay, well, I just wanted to finish off, you know, on where we think the Bank of England is going to go in terms of fighting inflation. It seems as if it's something that's going to stick around for a while, and that potentially the Chancellor's policies are not going to assist in reducing that. So do you see interest rates going much higher, I suppose, in the nearer term?
Well, so the point at which we're making this recording, and I normally wouldn't have to say that, but, you know, these economic events are moving very, very quickly. But the point we are speaking, the bank rate in the UK is 2.25%. Having steadily risen from its emergency level of 0.1%. And that has been, so we're already, if you like, 215 basis points or 2.15% of tightening. I would expect we're about halfway to where we're going to peak out. So something of the order of 4.5%. It has to be said, in the last few days, markets have seen it going 5-6%. In some cases, even 7%. And while there are arguments that it could have to do that in the event that sterling weakens a lot more, or there is more tax cuts to come, as Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng suggested shortly after his mini budget, I do think if you look at the rest of the world, and central banks tend to move in a herd, if you look at where the US, Eurozone seem to be heading in terms of their own interest rates, I think that 4 to 4.5% range feels about right. So we're about halfway on the journey of this cycle's interest rate tightening, in my view.
I just wondered as well, you know, the last rise was 0.5%, but the Fed had gone for a bigger rise than that. And there was some criticism levelled at the Bank of England that maybe they hadn't gone far enough, considering they were already a bit behind the curve with inflation. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would have gone for 0.75%. That was sort of public record that ahead of the meeting, that was how I read it. But I didn't get a vote. But I would say that you are correct to say it wasn't just the Fed and the ECB and the Bank of Canada. There's quite a lot of number of central banks who did 0.75%. In the Bank of England's defence, there were a couple of, if you like, points to add. First of all, at that meeting we just had, they begun the process, or they voted to begin the process of selling gilts, which is known as quantitative tapering. It's a bit of a mouthful, but this is selling the assets that they bought actually over the last 13 years. And that is analogous, it's similar to interest rate increases. So doing that at the same time as raising interest rates is, if you like, a dual tightening. And the second thing to say is, although it was a smaller increase than other central banks, the Bank of England was the second of the big central banks to get started with interest rate increases at the back end of last year, 2021. The New Zealand Central Bank were the first, but the Bank of England was second of the big major central banks. And so while there have been accusations that the bank were behind the curve, they weren't alone. And actually they've been going, coming up to a year now in this interest rate cycle, and they've generally gone steady as you go. First with 10 basis points, then 25, then 50. I don't think it's unreasonable to think they might have to go 75 if sterling remains where it is. But that's, if you like, the ramping up as more evidence becomes available on the economic impact during this recovery.
Simon French, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Marcus.
Okay, well, really great to speak to Simon there. It's amazing how much things change even just since Monday, and he was very cognizant of that too. But a really good dive into both of those areas, what's been going on with the budget and, of course, inflation. And I think quite an honest answer with him on why some of those economists didn't get it right. You know, they model things. There's a lot of inputs that go into that. And I think it's understandable why they had not got the expectations around energy so correct. Next time, we are going to look at a really interesting story that's based here in the UK. We're going to speak to Ryan Hughes, who's a really interesting guy from AJ Bell. I'm going to be talking about Neil Woodford, who was a phenomenal investor, was really seen as one of the UK's best investors, and then became persona non grata. So we're going to have a little look into why that was in case. Hope you all keep well. Until next time. Goodbye.